Lonnie Mack was a guitar icon in the world of music. According to his website, guitar lovers around the world know Lonnie Mack as a founding father of modern blues rock, the man who blazed the trail that Stevie Ray Vaughan, Eric Clapton, and many more have followed. Lonnie Mack was born on July 18, 1941, in Harrison, Indiana, and passed away on April 21, 2016, in a hospital near his home in Smithville, Tennessee. I'm Lee Hay, and tonight we'll celebrate his work on the blues. You'll hear from music historian Brian Powers, King Records engineer Chuck Seitz, and guitarist Stuart Holman, who played with Lonnie Mack in the 1970s. Here's Brian Powers.
Lonnie Mack grew up in Dearborn County, Indiana, which is just across the state line. He grew up in a family that was very musical. They used to play a lot of bluegrass stuff. They didn't have electricity, but apparently they had a battery-operated radio where they could listen to the Grand Ole Opry, and I'm sure they probably listened to WCKY, which played a lot of country music. This session that he did at King Studios was not for King Records. It was for Fraternity Records. But it was sort of not supposed to be a session, a Lonnie Mack session. He was recording for another artist. And then, basically, there was some time left over, and he did his recording, and that's now rock history. Because Lonnie Mack was a huge influence on Stevie Ray Vaughan. Stevie Ray Vaughan actually recorded one of his songs like three times in the 1980s, and I think Lonnie and him did some recordings together. So a big influence on him, and also an influence on Eric Clapton, and a lot of people considered him the first real rock guitarist. The engineer at King Records at the studio was Chuck Seitz. Chuck told me this story, which I thought was really funny. He had an opportunity to work in Nashville with Chet Atkins. Chet Atkins was looking for an engineer at RCA Studios. So Chuck had worked with James Brown. He'd worked with the Stanley Brothers, the Little Willie John. He's worked with all these people. But the record he put on top of the stack of albums was the Lonnie Mack LP. And he got the job. And when he talked to Chet Atkins, Chet Atkins said that that was the only one that he listened to that was on the top of the thing, and he played that record, and Chuck got the job. He didn't listen to anything else in the stack. It was just the Lonnie Mack album that got Chuck the job in Nashville, the Wham LP.
Thank you. This is Stuart Holman. Had the pleasure of playing with Lonnie Mack as his bass guitarist for about 3 years. I've been around a lot of musicians throughout my life and don't think I've ever been around one with more sheer power and raw talent than Lonnie Mack, with no exaggeration. Electric guitar players will often say that if you don't have tone, you have nothing. And great examples of that would be Eric Clapton and his Cream days, or Stevie Ray Vaughan. Now, those are players that established the fact that you're going to turn it up and play electric blues and rock and roll. Tone is critical. And Lonnie's tone early on was just absolutely penetrating and unique. Part of what made his tone unique was his talent coming through his fingertips, certainly, and the intensity. Part of his sound was his incredible use of the whammy bar. He would hold it with the fourth finger of his right hand, and as he picked in and out, that whammy bar would go with his hand, and he used it in an expressive way, unlike anybody to this day has used that technique. He also, particularly in his early days, played through magnetone amplifiers. They had a unique vibrato, unlike a Fender amp or your classic amps that would use vibrato by varying the volume of the instrument slightly in and out, or up and down, if you will. Magnetone actually took the tones and delayed the tone of the guitar and created kind of a soft and sweet vibrato, which was a big part of Lonnie's sound. Vocally, he was tremendously influenced by his musical experiences as a young child and was exposed to a lot of gospel music, and that has carried through his career from start to finish. Classic influences would be the tunes Wherever There's a Will, There's a Way, the tune that he wrote called Why, which he's recorded numerous times in a real gospel. He really embraced a lot of the early black rhythm and blues bands. And I Found a Love, if you've ever heard him perform that, it will send cold chills down your spine.
Oh, set my soul afire. Lord, see my one desire. And if she ever leave me, yeah, I feel like I would
of course, he addressed and embraced country music very intimately, always had an acoustic guitar handy and knew songs by a lot of the early country stars. And there was plenty of country influence, not only in his early music, but throughout the recorded music, all of his recorded music. An icon that we associate with Lonnie Mack is his 1958 Flying V Gibson guitar. Gibson introduced the Flying V in 1958, and they made a handful, 12 or 15 or 20 in that year, and I think Lonnie's serial number indicated it was maybe the ninth one ever made. And anybody around vintage guitars and around Lonnie Mack appreciates the fact that that guitar is incredibly special. A little bit on the guitar, they were originally made of Corina wood, and that's kind of a yellowish-colored wood, and they would put a clear finish on that. That changed several times throughout Lonnie's relationship with the instrument. At one point, I know he told me he had it painted purple to match his motorcycle, and it's currently and for years has been the classic deep red color that Gibson uses on their SGs and so forth. And that whammy bar, which is a Bigsby brand tailpiece that Lonnie used, there really was no way to fasten that whammy bar onto his guitar because the wings of the Flying V left a big open space there. And he took it to Glenn Hughes. Glenn had a store in Norwood, and that's where Glenn actually ordered the guitar for Lonnie. Glenn took a piece of iron and a strap and bent it around so that it would fit inside the wings of the Flying V and mounted that, and then that gave the tail end of the whammy bar a place to secure. Gibson, to show their appreciation to Lonnie, sometime in the 80s they put out a reissue of the Flying V, the Lonnie Mack version, and of course Gibson got the Bigsby tail pieces and bent the appropriate iron and constructed the whammy bar in the same way that Glenn Hughes had, which I think is very interesting. I remember Lonnie telling me that this is when I believe that the Gibson factory was in Nashville, And Lonnie told me that he'd gone there and dropped the guitar off in the morning and picked it up that afternoon, and that their technicians pored over it, measuring and photographing and so forth, so that they could make the reissue as close to his 1958 model as possible. I began playing guitar when I was 13. That made it 1963. That was the year that Memphis was recorded. Growing up in Cincinnati and hearing that sound was beyond inspirational for me. It was probably a big reason why I, at 60, I'm still playing and have always played. In 1963, as a teenager, I did not have access to recording equipment, didn't have tape recorders, let alone any sort of digital way to capture sound. So trying to learn Lonnie Mack's licks was problematic. My only tool was a little tiny RCA record player with a big 45 shaft in the center, and put the 45 on and let it spin and pick up the arm and try to set it exactly 3/8 of an inch from the beginning of the record where the solos start, and do your best and listen to it, set the arm off, try to play it, and then roll the dice and hope you got close to the solo when you put the arm back on the record. It was tedious, but it was all we had, so it was fine. If you're not familiar with his first album, Wham of the Memphis Man, that's some of the very best blue-eyed soul and white rhythm and blues that's ever been recorded, in my opinion. The band was just phenomenal. It was Hammond B3. It was Lonnie on guitar, bass, Hammond B3 organ, drums, two or three female background vocalists and a horn section. I understand, talking with Chuck Seitz, who engineered that session, that hit, to the best of his memory, the entire album was recorded in about 8 hours.
I'm setting, writing this letter, staying with it for mine. It says goodbye, darling, I love you, but you left me.
I'm with Chuck Seitz. Chuck has quite a reputation for being at King Records for a number of years and recording many of the acts, both solo and groups, that came through the studio there. Chuck, greetings and nice to be with you today.
Thank you. I was at King until the beginning of 64, and I had a good rapport with Sid Nathan there, in spite of what other people have said about him. Even after I went to RCA in Nashville, he wrote me in a 3 or 4 page letter one time, lining out what he still had planned and wanted me to come back. But at any rate, if we're talking about Lonnie Mack, I really wasn't too aware of Lonnie Mack until about 61, and I got a chance to record him in 63.
The story has it that he was working as a session player at King, and he was finishing up, you had finished a session with Gigi and the Charmaines.
Right.
Lonnie and his band, you had 20 minutes of remaining time, and you offered it to he and his band, and that's when Memphis was cut. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true. That's the way that turned out. I'd known Gigi and the Charmaines. They had a pretty nice little trio, and it was their desire to sound like the Supremes. And I even listened to some of the stuff Supremes were putting out and had hits on. And I told Gigi that the Detroit sound that came from the Supremes was dynamite. And I told her I didn't think that they'd ever get that sound unless they did it all themselves. The studios were just different, and the electronics in those days wasn't nearly as good as it is now.
You know that you mentioned that, Chuck, when I listen to the Charmaines, one of the things that crosses my mind is that it's coming from King Records, probably due to the reverb more than anything else.
There's something reverb was important. That's true. I don't know what they were doing in Detroit, but they had a different sound.
Tell me, if you would, what were your memories of that particular session and how that came about?
The Charmaines were rehearsed, and all three of them were good singers, and they had been friends and doing it for several years. The first time I heard of them was a couple of years before. Harry Carlson, the owner of Fraternity Records, had put out an album by them, and it had stirred up certainly a lot of local airplay. On the Billboard charts, it had appeared, but way, way down, you know.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any flashes at all while they were recording Memphis or while you were mixing that you had a hit on your hands?
No, not until we listened to it later. When the Charmaines were recording, they had an entirely different setup. We had a short time thereafter to set up for Lonnie. One thing I didn't understand or like was the rhythm sound, and I changed the microphone that I had on the bass drum and repositioned the mic I had overhead on the drums, and I repositioned the microphone on the piano because it was too soft a sound for Lonnie, where it would fit the Charmaines pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And it took maybe 10 or 15 minutes to rearrange the studio for Lonnie, and they did Memphis first, and I think we did 2 takes on that. Somebody wanted to take it on the first take, but Lonnie thought let's do one more just to have some insurance, and so we did.
Readjusting the mic on the tom-toms, I think, is interesting because the tom-tom plays a pretty important role in that tune.
Well, I agree with you in essence. In those days at King Records, we only used one mic for the drums, and we kept it pretty high so that we even would get bass drum in it, you know, and tom-toms, especially the low-end tom. And I liked the sound that I got, although if we'd have had 3 hours, I might have got a different sound. I don't know.
Let me ask you this. As far as the cuts that compiled his first album, which was called The Wham of the Memphis Man, recorded there at King, did you do those sessions as well?
Yeah.
If you remember, what was the period of time between cutting Memphis and then going ahead and cutting that album?
I don't remember exactly. I've got a note someplace that I looked up and found that actually we cut Memphis in March, and I would think that it was probably May or June. It wasn't too long after that because Memphis began taking off, and there was a lot of inquiries of what else have you got, and so Harry Carlson wanted to rush an album out, and so he scheduled the album, and it was fairly close after that, 2 or 3 months.
It was a spectacular piece of work. I'm just curious. I think I know the answer to this, but let me ask you anyway. There's organ on that. There's guitar. There's bass. There's drums. There's background vocalists, and there's a horn section. All those people in the studio at the same time?
Oh, yeah. We didn't do any overdubbing or adding on or anything. What you hear is what you got, what I had.
That's a phenomenal piece of work. That's a seminal rock and roll album, don't you think?
Yeah, although we weren't really pointing rock and roll as much as we were. We wanted a pop sound in there, too. If you remember, some of those vocals that he had were damn near pop.
Very much, and there was also a gospel influence in there.
Yeah, album, right.
Yeah. So I use the word rock and roll pretty loosely, I guess. Thanks for reminding me of that.
Yeah.
Another question. Let's say to start to finish, to record The Wham of the Memphis Man, which had probably a dozen cuts on it, something like that, and those are with all the musicians at King Records at the same time, what kind of time period are we looking at? Would you have spent perhaps doing the actual recording?
Well, I'm not sure about that, but union sessions are 3 hours, and you could only do four songs in that 3 hours. Now, I don't remember whether that was a union session or whether it was a non-union session, but we did the whole album, as I recall it, in two sessions, so it must not have been a union session. I imagine that we went about 4 hours twice.
So would it be correct to say, generally, in that era, with all the musicians live and no overdubbing, that first take or second take generally rapped about everything you did?
Well, I don't really know how to answer that. If a song was going good, we might took two or three cuts at it because they were rehearsed. It was a tight band. But I remember there was one song where we were having trouble with, and Lonnie says, throw it out. We ain't going to spend no more time on it. So we didn't even complete it. We were going into 7 or 8, 9, 10 takes, and it was wasting money.
Tell me this, Chuck. Why did you leave King Records?
Because I got a job as chief engineer with RCA Nashville.
And tell us about your career down there.
Well, I don't want to sound like I'm bragging, but I did real good. I was nominated 6 times for a Grammy. I'm not going to say any more than that.
It's been a pleasure to speak with you. Some terrific information. I'm a big fan of so many of the artists that recorded at King Records and feel like what went down there was very special and has yet to be recognized in the way that it really should be. And we'll hope that this conversation will help bring some of that recognition to
town. Okay.
Thanks so much, Chuck.
You're welcome.
Take care now. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
First time I met Lonnie Mack, having grown up idolizing him, if you will, and trying to emulate his guitar style. Later on in life, having lived in various locations around the country, returned to Cincinnati and got wind that he was living in Aurora, and I thought it would be good to look him up. So three or four of us piled in the car one night and drove out that direction and just started asking people where we might find him, and it wasn't difficult to get directions, and they said, up the holler, up this gravel road. Then you see a little white house on the right, and we took off in our car and headed up there and found what we thought might be the home. Didn't see anybody home. Got out of our car and looked in the window and probably saw some guitar laying around, or certainly appeared to be his house. And we wanted to leave him a note, so we had a brown grocery bag in the car, and we wrote a note thanking him for all the music that we'd heard and how much pleasure he'd given us, and we started writing down between the four of us every song we could ever remember that he recorded, and we had a list of 50 or 60, which, by the way, included an instrumental version of I Left My Heart in San Francisco. So we stuck that behind the door and headed back down the road, and lo and behold, if we didn't pass a car coming at us, it was a pickup truck, with a big burly guy with a black beard driving, and we said, that's our man. So we turned around and followed them back and arrived, as they did, at their home, and we introduced ourselves and were invited inside, and we stayed quite a lengthy time, and he was most personable. He and his family and his children, some couple of his kids were there, little babies were there, and we had a wonderful visit. I had moved from North Carolina up here to play with some friends of mine in a group called Calico Rose and the Coryville Cowboys. We had spent extensive time building that group by mailing little tiny reel-to-reel tapes together back and forth through the U.S. mail, and we were playing with great success in the Clifton area, packing them in, basically, and we'd maybe played 10 or 15 jobs at this point. Lonnie invited us to come out to the Friendship Park and join him in a music festival that was going to take place during the Muzzleloaders convention. We were happy to accept the invitation. We went out. It was like a little mini Woodstock, if you will, with a log cabin style stage in the middle of a big field and the Muzzleloaders firing and loading and shooting in the distance. And several acts were there. I don't remember other acts that day exactly. I know Rusty York was there playing his harmonica. And we played our set to a great response, and Lonnie was getting a little nervous because his bass player had not showed up. And I began to just kind of think that maybe he might need a bass player that night, and I would be more than happy to fill that role. And that ended up being my lucky night because their bass player didn't make it. I was completely familiar with all their material. Four-piece band started around 10 o'clock, and we were still playing when the sun came up the next morning. That band consisted of Michael Durham on drums and some vocals, Lonnie on guitar, of course, myself on bass, and Lonnie's brother Billy on guitar. So it was a sparse sound. It was really perfect for backing Lonnie, with the exception of perhaps having a good B3 sound. I ended up leaving the Calico Rose Band, much to their dismay and mine too. No hard feelings, but I just got a great opportunity and ended up playing with Lonnie about 3 years. A diverse bunch of gigs, would be putting it mildly. We played roadhouses all over. We played classic 50s kinds of events in outdoor venues and so forth. It was a wonderful experience. a couple of experiences I'd like to relate. We played a club in Mount Healthy once a week on a weeknight, maybe every Thursday. I don't remember the name of the club, but I do remember as time went along, it was a rough place, and I remember that I stopped parking my vehicle in the parking lot of the club because I was afraid that I was going to lose a window one night, and also was afraid that there were enough nights where I couldn't leave because the cops were there and they were blocking traffic. So I'd unload my equipment and drive my vehicle a couple of blocks down the street, and that way when the ruckus started in the parking lot, I could just ease out. Also, we played a series of weeknights at the Renaissance Club downtown, which I'm sure some of our listeners will remember from the mid-70s. That was a weekly affair. Our band was really good. We were tight as could be, and everybody focused on playing in the pocket. We had a great front man, needless to say, and everybody was there to back up Lonnie, and I think we gave him some great years there, tightly as we could. And one night, he really had the crowd stirred up, and he had a long guitar cord, and I remember him going out onto the dance floor and ended up kind of down on his knees, laying back kind of in a soulful, sort of a soul singer position, and then ended up sort of twisting around and lying flat on his back, wailing on his flying V, and everybody at the Renaissance Club standing around him in a circle, clapping their hands and cheering him on as he just... he played the guitar in a tremendous, tremendous fashion. On a fun note, rock and roll bands, blues bands, rhythm and blues bands have a reputation, I think, for enjoying their cold beverages. Our policy at the Renaissance Club was free liquor for the band. Well, I went up to the bar one night before we played, and I was instructed. I think I was instructed because they were hoping they didn't have to talk to Lonnie about it, but the drink code was going to change, and we were to have first drink free and half price on all remaining drinks. So now I realized it was my job to deliver this to the boss, and went back to our little hangout behind stage, and Lonnie came in, and I said, well, we got a new drink policy, and I explained it to him, and he didn't say a word. He just left, and he was gone a long time. He was gone a half hour or something like that. Pretty soon he came back with a gallon of Gallo Burgundy on his shoulder with his finger through that little ring hook there, and he had it up on his shoulder, and he said, well, boys, he says, here's my first free drink. That was memorable. Regarding him as a man, he is reclusive. He has very powerful feelings about friendship, and he has a tremendous sense of humor. He's a very intense person. He's as intense as his playing. His mind is always working. He picks up the guitar, and it's all business. It's 110% business all the time. He's extremely talented vocally and legendary tone-setting guitar player, and he's a very humble guy. He really insists on leading a simple life, an uncomplicated life, has no tolerance for the difficulties and politics of the music business, and I respect him for that. Sadly, Lonnie Mack is not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and this is, in many ways, the first American guitar player to turn it up and burn it up. Unfortunately for him, 1963, if I'm not mistaken, was also the year that the Beatles played the Ed Sullivan Show. So you have a rhythm and blues phenom who has more talent than you can imagine, and all of a sudden the tide shifts to the Liverpool scene and the backbeat of the Beatles, and he kind of got left in the, as did Roy Orbison, a number of great musicians who were really climbing to their peak at that time. I'm so thankful that his connection with Stevie Ray Vaughan brought Lonnie back into the public eye, and Stevie's acute appreciation for doing the same kinds of things that I did as a young guitar player and realizing that this burning sound was something that you wanted to learn and embrace. Stevie's recognition certainly was a great thing, I think, for Lonnie.
We'll be right back.
His legacy is his guitar playing and his singing, his tremendous ability to blend gospel and country and rock and roll and blues all into one very unique package. When you hear that guitar plug in and you hear the first two or three notes, you know who it is. And there aren't many guitar players that we can say that about.
Thank you. know? Do you have to know? I take what I get, play where I stay if you have to know. I'm a runaway engine on a midnight line. No destination, no track of time. The world bound your, the world bound mine. If you have to know. You have to know.
Been listening to a blues special about legendary guitarist Lonnie Mack, who passed away last Thursday, April 21st, 2016, at the age of 74. He's a musician who surely deserves to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Thanks for listening to The Blues on 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati and 88.5 WMUB Oxford. I'm Lee Hay.